Blog Talk Radio.
I haven't been on the show in a while. Excited. Today we're going to be talking about the means and end of education. So really we're going to be discussing two issues. The first is how to best educate an individual to go to college. And the second is really whether or not that goal of going to college should be the concern in K-12 education. So really the inspiration for our show today came from the work of Jeffrey Canada. And Jeffrey Canada is a graduate of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And Canada is originally from the South Bronx. And his goal in going to graduate school for education was to return to Harlem to educate and motivate children to go to college. And to do this, he started the Harlem Children's Zone, which is a huge program in Harlem that provides medical care for children. It has a couple of charter schools. This includes Baby College, which is another program he employed for children ages 0 to 3. And his goal was really to start at zero with children because he believed that you have to start there in order to help them to go to college. And so in his view, the program should help children go to college because his goal is to do that. As far as he's concerned, there's no other end. And so the issue here is the issue here really is that his goal is motivated by external rewards, and he motivates his students. He's very openly admitted to motivating his students through external motivation rather than intrinsic motivation. So Nick, do you want to discuss a little bit about extrinsic motivation and what it is?
Yeah, so I'm going to try to draw this distinction for you because it can get a bit technical with the words using extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. So extrinsic motivation, for example, this morning when I got up to go to work, I was extrinsically motivated. I it was freezing cold, it was 6 o'clock in the morning, and I had to get to work. The reason for going was that I need money. I absolutely need money to pay my bills and so on and so forth. So those are extrinsic motivators, things like money. Whereas intrinsic motivation, for example, I play disc golf, and I don't even have to have an extrinsic reason. Nobody needs to pay me. Nobody needs to tell me that I have to go. I don't have a responsibility to it other than to myself for its own sake. So I do the activity for its own sake. That's kind of the essence of intrinsic motivation, is that it comes from within. You get the reward from the activity that you're doing from yourself because you inherently enjoy it. Some people may experience this with their job, others not so much. But this is the distinction. So extrinsic being, it could be social pressure, it could be money, basically anything that is a reward that doesn't come from within. So I hope that will assist our listeners in understanding the difference between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation when we're using those technical terms. Also, I'd like to mention that me and Sandra would love to have any listeners call in to discuss these issues with us because, you know, they're highly belief-oriented, and, you know, we're going to be discussing these as a matters of philosophy or possibilities of what we think is valuable, good, beautiful, whatever. So feel free to call in. With that being said, Are we going to move to Canada's clip?
Yeah, we're going to play a clip. This is from 60 Minutes, and you can find the full version on our site, ethicstalk.cmish.edu, which they talk about his program, The Children's Zone. But this clip is where he talks about the way he motivates children to do the work, get the job done, and ultimately go to college. And he uses the word bribes. I think that's funny. But I'll just play the clip.
Canada calls his school the Promise Academy, and this is what he tells parents at the start of each year.
We promise our families, if your children are with us, we guarantee they're going to get into college, and we're going to stick with them through college, right? So that's the promise.
How can you, though, actually promise that they will go to college?
If my kids don't go to college, people who work for me are losing their jobs. And there's just no way around that.
You'll fire the teachers.
I will fire the teachers. I'll fire the after-school workers. I'll fire the directors. Everybody understands that this thing is our job as the adults. And we're not going to hold the kids responsible, right? And are some of my kids belligerent? Yes. Do some of them come in and don't try hard? Yes, they do. Do they come from broken homes? Yes. Is there poverty and drugs and crime? Yes, it's all those things. Those kids are still going to college.
My name is Rishar Nozier.
Rishar Nozier wasn't too sure about college when Ed Bradley first met him back in 2005. He was just in kindergarten.
You want to go to college?
Much as it kills me, yes.
Much as it kills you. Why would it kill you going to college?
Because they got people, words that I don't know.
But you'll learn new words every year. Trust me, you'll be okay.
Okay.
Today, Rishar is in the fifth grade and seems a lot more confident about college.
Do you know what college you want to go to?
Stanford.
What do you want to do after Stanford?
I would like to earn my way to being a CEO.
Why do you want to be the CEO?
To tell you the truth, I think you get paid better when you're CEO.
I think you're right.
If you work hard...
To make sure his kids succeed, Jeffrey Canada will do just about anything.
Who in this group went to Disney World this summer?
For younger students who ace their statewide tests, there are free trips. And he pays high schoolers up to $120 a month if they get near perfect attendance and grades.
Aren't you kind of basically bribing them?
I love to bribe kids. People say, well, Jeff, don't you want kids to do it for the intrinsic value of education? Sure, I'd love them to do it for the intrinsic value. And until then, I'd love them to do it for money. I don't care. I just want them to do it.
Okay, so that was the clip. And right at the end there, you got a little picture of how he's saying, yeah, you know, intrinsic motivation all the way. That's a good thing. However, this isn't the ideal world, and, I'm going to use whatever means necessary. I'm kind of speaking in Canada's voice. I'm going to use whatever means necessary to get these kids to college and off the streets. So I guess we're kind of discussing now, is this a legitimate way to go about getting kids motivated to go to school and go through the education system?
And I just want to emphasize, I don't know if I mentioned this, but Canada closed the achievement gap in Harlem, which is just unbelievable. And so that's what people are really saying about this issue, is that he's doing something amazing. And so this is, this requires some attention. So in terms of the clip, Nick, what's your response to just the way he's talking about the issue?
I think it's interesting. For the largest reason is because he brings out the idea that extrinsic motivation actually has this positive effect, which, we've talked several times on this show how extrinsic motivation can lead to, like, a result of less self-esteem and has some negative consequences, mm-hmm. whereas he's using the extrinsic motivators as a positive,
mm-hmm.
As
right.
something to,
right.
to motivate
mm-hmm.
children and
mm-hmm.
using it and being blatant about it,
mm-hmm.
Giving bribes of $120, if
right.
you get good grades,
right.
That's quite a chunk of change mm-hmm. to be throwing out, especially at a younger kid
right.
in the inner city of Harlem.
Mm-hmm. Right, and they, I mean, that's a huge deal for him. I know if you watch the full clip, I know earlier he mentions kids will come up to him and ask him, "Are you rich?" And he'll say, "Yes." And they're so amazed. Like, they're so amazed to meet someone because that equals power to them. And suddenly this man has power to help them. And so, I mean, it's so fascinating.
Yeah, and you get into you imagine the psyche of these kids. You know, they're growing up in the inner city, and what is life for them? Well, it is those extrinsic things. It is money. It is food, because those are the needs that aren't necessarily being met, that so many of us perhaps, you know, just take for granted. These kids perhaps are on that opposite side of the spectrum, where it's like, I don't know if I'm going to get dinner tonight or not. And so all of a sudden, money becomes much more relevant in a student's or in a student's pursuits. You know, and it's interesting. I have a few friends from India, and they are so always talking about their responsibility to get a job, to make money, to support a family. Like, that is just drilled into them. You know, I've heard it from several of them. You know, and not saying that that's a bad thing, but it's, I think it's just a different, it comes from a different perspective than, you know, the suburban white kid like myself. Who, you know, never really had any troubles meeting those extrinsic needs. While we're talking about this this program, the Harlem Children's Zone and Canada, I think it's important to mention that in the clip, they some commentators on it say, you know, I don't know exactly how he's doing it, but it's working, you know. And then they talked about how the individual aspect of the program itself and how it's really Canada's vision that's really pulling it through, and you know, it kind of alluded to that. You know, it's not so much this strict format of education that we need to be going after, but rather a more entrepreneurial one, where you know, people are pursuing their individual ideas about how to best facilitate a healthy education. So I just wanted to mention that.
So there's the question of, is this a good way to educate?
You know, I think it's interesting that when we're younger, we're motivated, I think, highly by extrinsic extrinsic things. You know, like, you see a cookie in front of you, you say, hey, if you work for 15 minutes on writing this down, you know, the kid's way more likely to do it than if he doesn't get any, you know, extrinsic reward. And so I think early on you have this idea of extrinsic extrinsic ideas to motivate. However, how long does this continue on? And, you know, it's kind of like, how many cookies do you allow, you know, but think about this way later on in life. Like, how many cookies are you just going to keep taking? Are you going to take all the cookies from all the other children, you know, if that serves as your reward? You know, because if you're extrinsically motivated, then the idea would be get as many cookies as you can and not share with the rest, you know. And this idea transcends into the adult realm with human greed and, you know, we can talk about the banks and why we're kind of in the economic issues we are now is due to human greed. But so that said, it's like, you know, if this is, you know, this may, I don't know if this is a good way to educate, because I don't know how it's going to, in the longitudinal, you know, in the long span of time, if this is going to continually perpetuate extrinsic motivation to get people to act.
Well, let me, can I share a little story, my own experience with extrinsic motivation and education? So I'm a graduate student here at Central Michigan University, and I'm a graduate assistant in the CMU Writing Center, a great place to go for any degree of writing needs. And I work quite often, quite a bit with we call it basic writing. So students, anything before, well, anything in the English department before English 101 is basic writing, and most often that's freshmen. Students coming in, and what we do is we have students come in each week to meet one-on-one with a consultant regularly. So I had a student who I started working with, and he was from the lower economic demographic and really had a difficult time, had a very difficult time writing. And not only that, but our interactions were somewhat awkward, too. I felt like he didn't like me. So But I decided one day, we keep a bucket of candy at the front desk, and I thought, we had some great candy. I'm going to have a piece of candy. So I said, hey, would you like a piece of candy? And he's like, yeah, sure. So I gave him a piece of candy. And the next week he comes in, and he sits down, and he starts to work, and he looks at me, and he says, can I have another piece of candy? Can I have a sucker? And I was like, sure. So this became a weekly thing for us. And he started to like me, Nick. Like, he started to, like, there was, like, warmth between us after this candy situation. So I almost felt like, and I don't know that it was the candy that was bringing him to the Writing Center, but it was certainly the candy that helped him to become comfortable in the Writing Center. And so I would say, to relate this to what Canada's doing, like, and I'm pretty sure with younger children, like, going to Disney World, like, that's a pretty big motivator. But those things might also help them feel comfortable in that environment. That notion that I can have this, you know, $140. Well, maybe this will, you know, eventually I'll have $104,000 a year. So I don't know. I mean, it's just a thought. But I guess my philosophy in experiencing that and using that is kind of a bribe in a way to, like, get him to like me, but I can use those opportunities to, like, explain to him why writing is important or why it's valuable. So it gets their attention, right? And so that's kind of been my experience, and I think in Canada's experience too, that gets their attention. A trip to Disney World, that's gonna get their attention, and when maybe math problems won't. Right?
Absolutely, and you know, and to get these kids to. Because it's not so easy when you're learning a math problem to understand how it's going to be relevant to use later on in life,
right?
You know, and so I think by, you know, starting them off on these extrinsic motivators to get them to do things that are not necessarily inside of what they want to be doing, they, as a consequence, acquire skills that will be used later on to help them make it through life.
Right.
You know, so I do see value in it. You know, I'm having a hard time kind of formulating, like, wherein I see it as a negative thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because like people are saying, it works. Like, it's working. People, you know, he closed the achievement gap.
On the other hand, you know, looking at extrinsic motivation again, it comes back to, like, there's no value driving behind what people are doing anymore. Then it becomes strictly for these things like money and not the activity itself. So somebody can totally debauch the activity they're involved in, whether it's, you know, writing a paper and you know, plagiarizing, or, you know, any, you know, or somebody cheating in the job force, taking credit for something that somebody else did by stealing some idea, you know. And so I think ethics gets undermined. But that brings up an interesting question. Mm-hmm. So wherein should, you know, K through 12 especially, should there be an ethical education, if any at all?
Oh, that's a really good question. I guess, in other words, whose role is it to educate the morals of children? Right? Whose is it, the parents' job? And I know growing up, my father was vehement in that the school, the government, right? The government is not going to educate my children. I'm going to educate my children, because we have the sense of autonomy and property in a way, because, like, children kind of are parents' property, and they feel that they have the right to give them that training, and the school should do the more pragmatic 1+1 and read and write. So that's an interesting question.
For me, I understand, you know, parents want to raise their children inside of their own set of beliefs, and I actually think this has an adverse effect on the child's mental well-being. Suppose you're raised in some, you know, Catholic dogma.
Right.
It becomes very hard to refuse that ideology if a child's curious about pursuing something else because of the love for that parent. So they're, you know, their curious understanding or, you know, trying to reach this understanding of something is atrophied. You know, it no longer wants to work because it wants the parents to love it, you know.
Right.
And so I think that has an adverse effect on autonomy. And so, you know, for me, in an ideal world, very much so through K through 12, there would be moral education. Mm-hmm. Now the question is, so what is, what should the moral education be?
Right. What does that look like?
So do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I know I have an aunt who teaches kindergarten in elementary school, public elementary school, and they were doing this thing called character counts. So they were talking about character. They used the word character, and they talked about there were subsets in that character, and I can't remember, like honesty, things like that, which I think those are pretty broad values. Like most people, I guess most people value honesty. Most people value, what are other things? Like building the character of their children, right? But you have to draw a line somewhere. Like, certainly that you can't implement religious values in that. So, I think that's certainly fair. Because look at it this way: a school teacher, a principal, whomever, can punish a child for behaving badly. So that kind of indicates that they're promoting a notion of right and wrong. They're saying this is wrong, this is right. You should behave this way. If not, you're gonna have a timeout or go to the principal's office or be in detention. So, and by implementing those things, they're saying that there's a correct way, and so I think that's a pretty general thing. But I'm not sure where the line should be drawn. I'm not sure how much value, because the thing is in public education, parents. I've heard this. Parents get involved over the most minute things. Like if you show a movie that they're uncomfortable with, they're horrified. If you give the child a grade that they don't think is appropriate, they're horrified. So there's a lot of risks that schools take or don't want to take. And so I certainly think that's something to consider. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, it is interesting to think that there is already a level of moral education that is being administered, you know. And it seems like very much on a social kind of norm way, you know, whatever is socially normal, you know, that's what's considered good.
Right.
Now, I also think that kids at, you know, in kindergarten are so, so, and even all the way through high school, even into college, are very much malleable in their beliefs.
Right.
And I think that can bring up a fear in a parent, you know, especially if they want their kids to have a certain moral belief about certain things.
Right.
Then it becomes very much a matter to the parents. But the case that I would argue is that, you know, it's, you know, moral education should be used with as much rigor as you know, as mathematics, as arithmetic, reading, writing, and I think the way to do this is really again through dialogue, you know, and allow the students to work themselves through certain moral issues and to talk about them amongst themselves, where the teacher would only be a facilitator of questions, you know. Mm-hmm. Like today we're going to be presented with this problem, you know, like how do you go about solving it, you know? Is there a problem? Ask them if there's any problems in them in their lives and allow the children to discuss amongst themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there is, again, another fear of children doing that. And in part, I think it's because you would see these conflicting ideologies of the parents that the kids would be imitating.
Right.
And so... you know, they'd be exposed to all these different ideologies, and what would they do with them?
Right.
And I think too much we would give our own, we would be imposing our own political and, you know, political things onto what these children are saying, when I think children, for the most part, are very descriptive.
Right.
You know, so they don't really associate a particular value to the thing, you know. It's it's pretty much just, it is what it is.
Right.
So I don't know if I exhausted saying that, but I think, you know, that children ought to be discussing amongst themselves what's right and wrong. And perhaps it's not right to introduce it in kindergarten, you know, or K through 6, you know, I don't even know. But
That's an interesting thing, interesting issue you bring up. So this notion that children can figure out what is right and wrong? Is that what you're saying? Like, if they discuss amongst themselves, no adults involved in this, just children talking about right and wrong.
I think so.
Okay.
I think it becomes a matter, you know, well, what is it, you know, what I would think is that, you know, some of these kids would be more exposed mm-hmm. to a moral education than others.
Right.
You know, some parents mm-hmm. might not put so much emphasis mm-hmm. on one thing, whereas another parent puts another mm-hmm. emphasis on another thing.
Right.
So you would see these mm-hmm. kids at an early
right.
age engaging in mm-hmm. these differences,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that in itself is a moral education, dealing
right.
with people who think differently than you.
Yeah, but at the same time, here in playing devil's advocate here, you're subverting the issue of experience, right? So adults have a certain level of experience of right and wrong. Maybe that pollutes them. I mean, maybe they're polluted by that. Maybe they're polluted by the world. So maybe children have this purer sense of what's correct and incorrect, or what's right and wrong, what's good and bad. But I do think experience is important. I do think observing the world for however many years is important, because children have only so much experience. But and they think about it in smaller terms, like sharing a toy or lying to their sister.
I totally agree with mm-hmm. that. I mean, I think that's where the maxim respect
right.
your elders comes from.
Sure.
You know, it's this idea
mm-hmm.
that, you know, they have so much realm of experience
right.
within a particular thing.
Sure.
They're pretty well off to,
mm-hmm.
you know, and probably have heard several different arguments against
mm-hmm.
their belief,
right.
and as a consequence, their belief is even stronger because they've
mm-hmm.
refuted those arguments,
yeah.
and so they have a
mm-hmm.
pretty good understanding
right.
of some particular belief.
Yeah.
But you know, again, like, does the child really know that, or do they just
mm-hmm.
acquiesce, or do
right.
they just come to the understanding of the adult without understanding
right.
it themselves?
Right.
You know, and
yeah.
so what if it's the case that, you know, they have this
mm-hmm.
maxim in their head, but they have no justification
right.
for it?
Well, that was my experience. I mean, I remember until, I don't know how old I was, maybe in my early teens, whatever my dad said was right, I believed. And you know, not until I was old enough to question those things. Because you don't question them as a kid. I thought he was right. I thought he was infallible. I mean, so, and maybe that was, I don't think that was necessarily a bad thing, but I don't know if it was a good thing either. I mean, I certainly felt like I was a good kid, but I don't know.
Yeah, and I would just like to put out a little disclaimer. Like,
mm-hmm.
what me and Sandra are talking about right now are very general ideas,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's very much
mm-hmm.
a relative topic
mm-hmm.
to the child's
right.
own intuitions and experiences of the
mm-hmm.
world. You know, people
right.
can have almost identical situations and end up completely different people.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
So,
look at siblings. I mean,
yeah.
So yeah, and again, if you want to call in, it looks like we have a caller right now. Hello, caller.
Hello.
Hello, caller.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Ethics Talk.
It's your biggest fan.
Oh, so glad.
So I want to go back to this. I think it's a tacit assumption, or maybe it's not so tacit, but that you guys are talking about moral education with children.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that, you know, the tacit / explicit possibly assumption that I'm picking up on is that one ought to be able to justify, you know, these maxims like obey one's elders. And that is, like, essentially what being moral is, or what moral education is. And I want to challenge that. I think that's a very, you know, dominant view in analytic philosophy, that to be a moral person is basically to be able to justify one's reasons for acting and blah, 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 and make sure that one is, like, coherent and consistent in one's belief set, et cetera. And I just want to, you know, bring up once again, because we've talked about it repeatedly on this show, and I think it's especially relevant also to the issue of extrinsic motivation, but this issue of habit. And so it's one thing to be able to, whatever, spout off, you know, a rational justification for a moral maxim beautifully, like in a courtroom, like as an argument. And it's another thing to, you know, have, quote unquote, good habits that conduce to human flourishing, whatever that is. And so I would say that it's not, I definitely think that, you know, logical, rational analysis and so forth are a part of moral behavior. But actually, since last week's show is on Aristotle, I'll mention that what he actually says about moral virtue is that knowledge counts for little, if anything, and that really it's mainly about the intrinsic motivation and the habitual doing of the thing that that makes an action morally virtuous. But to connect to extrinsic motivation, and if I'm just blathering on, just say stop. But this question of whether, you know, these extrinsic motivators that Jeffrey Canada are using are really in the long run harmful. There's actually some research that shows that extrinsic motivators are not necessarily harmful so long as the activity is already intrinsically enjoyable. And again, going back to last week's discussion of Aristotle, and I think you guys would also agree that children do seem to just be curious about the world, and there seems to be an innate desire for knowledge. So it could be the case that human beings are built in such a way that they're already intrinsically motivated to learn, or not. I mean, that's something that, I don't know, Sandra, you were talking about how you're working in the Writing Center, and you guys are also students, and you can look around and ask whether you think people's love of learning is fully developed, et cetera. But in any case, the tricky thing with using extrinsic motivation, given the fact that actions become habitual, right? Then there's like this perceived causal connection, like if I do this, I'm going to get a sucker, or if I do this, I'm going to get $120. And the reason to, you know, excel is because I'm going to get some external contingency. So the danger is that the individual starts to see this causal connection and expect an external reward if they do this thing that they're supposed to be doing for intrinsic reasons. And that's very, very tricky. And the 60 Minutes clip, I forget the student's name, but his motivation is to be a CEO because they make more money.
Right.
And so it just, like, is that going to stick with him his whole life? So that's just something to, anyway. So 2 points. One, I mean, the main thing I'm trying to say is let's not forget the role that habit plays and action plays in moral behavior. It's not just like being able to justify one's beliefs, and that may not be even like the main part of moral behavior, just throwing it out there.
But, you know, that raises an interesting question. I mean, and I'd be interested to know what Canada's goals were initially. Was his goal always to go and get a master's of education and do this? Or was he initially motivated by money?
That's, you know, I don't know his story.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either. But I mean, I'd be interested to find out.
I don't think he was. I mean, I doubt he was motivated by money.
Right.
But again, I don't know. And you know, the type of program that he has, you know, strongly suggests that what's motivating him, first and foremost, is like helping these kids.
Right.
That's what's motivating him, and that's what drove him to college. I do know of another individual who's like an educational reformer, and I think his name is James Comer. And he was motivated by the fact that people, his friends, he's black also, I believe he's at Yale, but his friends who were just as intelligent as he was, basically like one ended up dead and one ended up an alcoholic, and James Comer did okay, and he wanted to understand why. Like, he was very disturbed at that. Like, why is this happening to my friends? And he was driven to understand this and pursued psychology and so forth.
Yeah.
And, you know, so this is drive to understand, and now he's also created sort of a school program for inner city people in poverty and so forth. So, given what these people are doing, I highly doubt that they're driven by money, but again, you know, it's a very, very tricky thing, and our whole society, I would say, is driven by extrinsic motivators.
Sure.
I mean, you guys agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I don't know how heavy it is, But I imagine it's, you know, like 70-30, 70 extrinsic, 30 not.
Do you think, like, the people who are, I mean, you know, you mentioned Wall Street before, Nick. What do you think about that in terms of what's motivating the people on Wall Street? And the, you know, the effects, like the power that those, the actions of individuals on Wall Street has on the society at large is scary, actually.
Yeah, it's frightening. And so, I mean, you know, that raises an interesting question. You know, do people that have tons and tons of money, or for that matter, lots of power, is their main thing extrinsic motivation, you know, to climb this ladder kind of deal?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that's always the case, but I think a large majority, it is the case.
Yeah, I think it's big time the case. And, you know, it could be status, it could be money, it could be power, but it's just some sort of, like, external marker of your success rather than this sort of this activity that you engage in for its own sake, and finding that is what success is, and being able to live off of it. But anyway, I just wanted to, you know, mention those things.
All right, well, real quick, I want to go back to your concept of moral education being more based on habit and that being action habits, your actual body being involved in something. So I was wondering if you had any, like, anything you would prescribe to, like, some sort of example of what moral education would look like in your ideal world.
Sure. So when I was in high school, we had this thing called Project Adventure. And it's basically, like, how can I describe it? But you climb, like, these telephone poles, like, very high telephone poles, and you stand on top of a telephone pole, and you jump across onto a trapeze. You know, very scary things. And this was, like, a very rare thing at the time when I was in high school. I remember it was, like, my senior year. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm afraid of heights. I hate rides. I mean, I don't get sick, but I don't find pleasure in it at all. And I saw this as an opportunity to, you know, build confidence, face my fear, stuff like that. So I chose to do it, and I think it's because, you know, that sort of practice was encouraged in my household, and you know, a school could do that as well, and this could be part of gym. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. So there's specific activities that you can engage in to build your confidence, face your fears, so forth. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, that's an excellent example. Secondly, I would like to ask, like, what do you think how high do you think the role of extrinsic motivators are within you? Because for me, it's like I experience extrinsic motivation. It's all around me. And so I was just wondering at your level, I mean, is the ideal to get completely away from the extrinsic and be solely focused on the intrinsic, or is there some value within the extrinsic?
You know, Nick, I'm just so focused on trying to get my grades done. I can't even focus on that question. But, for me personally, you know, and who knows if I'm engaged in a glorious act of self-deception, but I think it's, you know, largely intrinsic. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
I'm not going to go into my life story. I'll just answer it that way.
All right. That sounds good.
So I pursued, you know, a PhD because I had philosophy in high school and loved it. And when I had it in high school, I said, this is what I think about all the time. And I realized that I could do this, you know, as a job. And it was not the fact, like, I need a job that drove me to it, but it's that I already found something that I love to do, and I realized I could do that as a job.
Right. So. I also have one more question for you, and I'm not quite sure how I'm going to word it yet, so bear with me. But you mentioned how if somebody's getting extrinsically motivated throughout their education, Let's say this is Canada's program. I'm not saying this is the case. This is hypothetical. Mm-hmm. But that a kid goes through and he's constantly extrinsically motivated by doing some activity. And then let's say he graduates and you know, he gets this job and he's not even getting as much extrinsic rewards as he was getting prior to whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's this kind of despair. And I guess I was trying to figure out a way to connect this with the way that I think college graduates or the college kind of mindset is that you have this sense of entitlement after you receive your degree. And I think in large it's due to the fact that we have this positive extrinsic motivation or like this social pressure to go to college, and then we have to pay all this money to go to college. So, like, if I go through college, you know, and I'm paying all this money and everybody tells me I should, then I feel I deserve something after I'm out of college. And so I feel that that kind of paradigm or that kind of issue of being extrinsically motivated shows itself when people feel a sense of entitlement after they get their degree.
I don't know if this is really addressing the point, but instead of entitlement, I would say, you know, there's this expectation that if I go to college, like, I will be fulfilled. Like, this is what society is telling me I need to do, and so therefore, if I do it, I will be fulfilled.
Yes.
Right.
And so people realize, as you guys know, because we've talked about this, that when many people leave college, they're not fulfilled. And the question is, why? And so people will resort to their, you know, the old standbys where maybe it's my partner, my partner is wrong, or maybe it's, you know, it's like the question is, what's the cause of the lack of fulfillment?
Sure.
And I do know that people who are heavily motivated by, like, wealth and status, like, it never can satisfy. Like, there's always somebody bigger than you. I forgot the guy's name, but there was a 60 Minutes piece on, he was like another Bernie Madoff character. And his goal was to just be like the guy in New York, like the cool guy who had the coolest parties. And he had a thriving law practice. I mean, very esteemed law practice. And he just wanted more. And I mean, there was something that was not being fulfilled in him. And so his explanation was, oh, I just have to like have a bigger party and I have to have more cars and I have to have, you know, a more fancy building. And it led him to actually fabricating clients and deals, and he actually ended up impersonating another lawyer and was arrested for that. I forget this guy's name. It's a really fascinating story. So the question is, like, what does the person see as the cause of the lack of fulfillment? And if you're so accustomed to, like, extrinsic motivators, you may think it's the lack of that or I need more of that. And that will satisfy me. And you become engaged in this sort of, and it becomes habitual, this routine. And I think that we don't really talk about intrinsic motivation in our society enough, and people don't understand that, you know, the cause of their lack of fulfillment could be the lack of this type of activity in their life. Does that make sense?
I would go so far as, like, I think it's hard for people to identify what level of happiness they're experiencing or what, you know, value they're, because it's really a question of, like, you know, it's a question about the self. How happy am I? And if you've never been intrinsically motivated and you've only had these extrinsic means of motivating yourself and fulfilling those extrinsic means, then all of a sudden, like, your happiness, that's all there is. I mean, there is no conception of the intrinsic.
That's right. And so both Mill and Aristotle talk about, like, there are certain people who haven't tasted, you know, the quote-unquote higher, nobler pleasures, and I would, you know, use that language as well, and I would say there's many people who have never tasted. You know, they may have, like, these episodic moments where they're doing things, but to, like, be, to have one's life fully packed, I used this expression last week, with, you know, these types of activities, I just, you know, I know. And it's hard to do, but anyway. So on that note, if I may leave you guys to your discussion. Sorry for taking you off the...
Okay, it was great.
Yeah, it was fantastic to have you on. Feel free to call in again if you get some inspiration from something that's...
But yeah, I just want to, you know, again, just make the connection with habit, because I think that's what you're alluding to, Nick. Like, these people get so used to these extrinsic motivators, and again, Aristotle, like, what you are is what you do. Or there's a Buddhist phrase that says, if you want to know what you're going to be doing in the future, look at yourself in the present. Because that will determine what actions you perform in the future. Mm-hmm. And, what we do now determines what we will do in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so if everything you're doing is for an extrinsic motivator, then that's going to leave a deep residue on your nervous system, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll just be sort of built, you will build yourself that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes very hard to undo the habits. It's like an alcoholic, you know, stopping the addiction. So,
yeah.
Anyway. So, okay, guys.
Right,
great show.
Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for chatting. All right. Bye.
To back up what our favorite caller, Dr. Hope May, had just said, there is a chapter called The Laws of Habit in William James's Talks to Teachers on Psychology and to Students on Some of Life's Ideals. Heck of a long title. But he quotes a passage from Darwin's autobiography on the subject of habit. And I'm just going to read what Darwin says. It's fairly short, and then we're going to kind of respond to it. So Darwin says, up to the age of 30 or beyond it, poetry of many kinds gave me great pleasure, and even as a schoolboy I took intense delight in Shakespeare, especially in the historical plays. I have also said that pictures formerly gave me considerable and music very great delight. But now, for many years, I cannot endure to read a line of poetry. I have tried lately to read Shakespeare and found it so intolerably dull that it nauseated me. I have also almost lost my taste for pictures or music. My mind seems to have become a kind of machine for grinding general laws out of large collections of facts. But why this should have caused the atrophy of that part of the brain alone on which the higher tastes depend, I cannot conceive. If I had to live my life again, I would have made a rule to read some poetry and listen to some music at least once every week, for perhaps the parts of my brain now atrophied would thus have been kept alive through use.
Mm-hmm.
The loss of these tastes is a loss of happiness and may possibly be injurious to the intellect and more probably to the moral character by enfeebling the emotional part of our nature.
Hmm.
Again, that was Charles Darwin, or major founder of evolution. And
an uncoverer, maybe not founder.
Well, yeah, founder of the theory of evolution.
Yeah.
I don't even know if that's true. Maybe there was some dude that nobody really knew about that had come up with it before, Darwin.
Yeah.
But in any case, somebody with a well-developed intellect writing this in his autobiography, I think, is pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that the activities that he found intrinsically motivating actually through habit became atrophied to the point where he couldn't even no longer enjoy those things. And so to bring that back to the caller's point, if you're raised in this habit of extrinsic motivators, it can have a far negative consequence on enjoying things that may be meaningful to you.
Hmm.
Couldn't
it just be, I'm just going to throw this out there, couldn't it just be said in for Darwin, maybe he just got sick of it, right? I mean, maybe if he would have been presented with some other poem, like it might have been more, he might still find that intrinsic motivation. Maybe I'm just misunderstanding it. But, I mean, Shakespeare can be pretty dull. Like after a while, maybe he just needed something new.
Yeah, maybe he did just get bored with it.
But that wasn't his end. You know, his end wasn't tied up in poetry, so.
Yeah, it just seems like he's suggesting here that, he took some time off. I don't know. I'm trying to find the line there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in any case, you know, he wishes that he still enjoyed it.
Right.
Still got the feelings that he had from it.
Right.
And he says he suffers some sort of emotional
trauma
from it.
Sure.
You also get an opposite picture, which is interesting, of Mill's life. Mill was raised by Jeremy Bentham and his father, James Mill, who both raised him in a very strict academic life, to the point where he didn't even have the ability to communicate, you know, with people of his own age. He was, I think he was speaking Latin by the time he was seven, and being raised to be this, like, prodigy child. And he had a breakdown, I believe, when he was 17, where he read a poem and he started to cry, you know. So you kind of see this opposite thing happen where he had been, you know, kind of drilled into him from his society of what was valuable. And then gradually, you know, he had this moment where he awakened and said, I can't do this any longer. You know, I can no longer be this rational, nothing but rational creature, because he was raised completely in utilitarianism as well as within an atheist dogma. So
it's interesting.
Yeah, so you kind of get the flip side of that, that almost like some discovery happens later. And so, you know, I guess in a sense, and William James says this in The Laws of Habit, that, you know, I'm not discounting the possibility for somebody to make a drastic change in their life, you know, provided some certain circumstances. But he says for the general part, it's very hard. And you can contrast this with an analogy with alcoholics. You know, somebody who's drank, you know, for the last 15 years very heavily, the odds of them stopping on their own cold turkey is, you know, is slim to none. So, but there are cases of people doing it. The power of the will, I think, is really powerful, you know. But
I mean, and so to go back to what Canada's doing, and to go back to this issue of bribing children or encouraging them to go to do the work and to go to college through extrinsic motivators, what is that? What do you think is going to be the grand outcome of that? I mean, I know he has a specific kind of vision, and that is that people are going to be, colleges are going to be wanting kids from Harlem. I think that's what he says. Again, if you watch the 60 Minutes clip. That's his end. That's when he feels like he'll be successful. But what does that mean for careers? I mean, what does that mean for in terms of what these kids are going to be contributing to society? Is it going to be? Are they all going to be CEOs? I mean, I guess that's the question in my mind. Is that, well, maybe that's now. Maybe right now. I mean, I know habit certainly plays into it, but maybe this is my hope, that through like the process of education, they're going to have that aha moment, right? That moment where they read the poem, or they see the data, or they do they solve the math problem, or something that sparks something in them to move beyond that CEO end, right? To move beyond that dollar sign end. I mean, that's my hope. Is that possible? I mean, I'm sure it's possible, but is that likely, right? Do you think maybe that could be? That could change. Maybe that kid's voice will change, and he won't be saying, "Yeah, I want to be CEO because they make money." He'll be saying, "Yeah, I want to be a sociologist because I want to study how to change these demographics." Right?
You know, I would say, it's a very relative question, and I think it depends largely on what the values are around him. If the values are money, then it's going to be the case that will be the pursuit of, you know, and that goes for most people. If you're around a bunch of people who are in nothing but who consider success equates to money, you know, to having a lot of money, then that person is going to try to achieve that.
Right.
Unless they have that aha moment. And if Hope's theory is correct, which I think she had said this, I don't know if she did, but that we have this innate desire to learn, you know, and we have this natural curiosity. And so I truly believe this is the case too. And, you know, it may be the case that somebody has a CEO in mind, but along in route, you know, again, this understanding or this curious understanding is awakened. And it may be the case that they use that curious understanding still to get to that CEO spot. But once they're there, maybe mm-hmm. then they'll be able to right. make the connection and say, well, mm-hmm. I'm here now. Now what?
Right.
You know,
because sure.
there's no here, mm-hmm. you know, there's,
right.
you know, there's
right.
nothing there when you get there.
Yeah. And that brings up another point of what these kids need to be exposed to. I would argue what they need to be exposed to is look at the economy. Look at where money can fail you. Right. It might seem like it's good now because you're living in poverty. But look how quickly it could be taken from you. And then what's your job as a CEO then? What is it
right.
then? But if you are something else, if your identity is tied up in something else and not money, I really feel like this is where it would hit home, is that then they can see that no matter what happens, no matter how many times the economy fails, I can go back to this thing. I can go back to my writing. I can go back to the science or the math or whatever it is for that person. So I think that's a huge thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that it's too often failed,
mm-hmm.
especially in the high school setting,
mm-hmm.
where I think that would be most important, is mm-hmm. to have these discussions about, like, okay,
mm-hmm.
like, what's your dream job? You know,
right.
what do you
mm-hmm.
want to do? You know, and regardless
mm-hmm.
of the answer,
right.
that they are probed, you know, or questioned extremely, extremely hard, you know,
right.
like,
mm-hmm.
think about this, you know, what about mm-hmm. in this scenario? And,
mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
especially with the question of money, because
right.
money is such a, you know, it's a fleeting
right.
thing. You know,
sure.
we have no idea,
right.
as much as our lives are too.
Right.
And, you know, the recognition of death, I think is very important to
yeah.
people living a valuable
right.
life.
Right, and oh, that's a great point. And that confrontation, that the keeping in the forefront of your mind that issue of mortality and that we are mortal beings, I think that tends to deter people from pursuing money as an end. I mean, maybe I'm just living in an ideal world, but it does for me. I don't want my tombstone. We talked in previous shows about the tombstone question. What do you want your tombstone to say? I don't want it to say that I was a CEO and they made a buttload of money. I think that's a great point.
Yeah, or you ask, like, you know, what did I leave
mm-hmm.
behind?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to
mm-hmm.
say that I left
mm-hmm.
behind a bank account
right.
with, you know, $5
right.
million dollars
right.
in it, never,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, that
right.
just seems,
mm-hmm.
it seems totally
right.
worthless.
But here's another issue. To give credit to CEOs, if this kid, I forgot his name too, interviewed in 60 Minutes, if he's going to be a CEO, maybe his goal is to give money back to these schools. Maybe his goal is to start more of these schools. So that would be a great end. You know, that's a different issue, right, to make money, to have your greater end being giving back. But if your end is just the money, then I think there's the problem. So I think that's a point that should be made.
And I think again, this goes back to the individual mm-hmm. power, I think, that
mm-hmm.
each circumstance provides.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In Canada's case,
mm-hmm.
for me, I see what he's doing as
mm-hmm.
amazing, as
yeah.
as it's an ideal form for these
yeah.
kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again,
yeah.
that's just me. But, you know, mm-hmm. maybe in other circumstances
mm-hmm.
that's not the appropriate mm-hmm. case.
Right.
You know, that's not something that needs to be, you know, facilitated
mm-hmm.
in such a manner.
Right.
You know, where, like, for example, in, you know, some affluent area, you know, like, maybe it's the case, like, you know, you need to expose the kids to poverty,
mm-hmm.
you know, or maybe.
Sure.
You
I
know,
think that works. Yeah, yeah.
Because
mm-hmm.
I doubt that money has much value to them at all. You
right.
know? Whereas money has a ton of value
mm-hmm.
to these other people.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's
yeah,
it's an interesting topic.
Yeah, and I think in saying that discussing the relativity of the situation and how it pertains to certain demographics and certain groups is important, because it certainly does. And these kids are going to view money in a much different way than a middle-class kid would or an upper-class kid would. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well,
we have about 2 minutes left on the show. Any final thoughts, Nick, in terms of our discussion today? I mean, here's one last question. So if extrinsic, I know we've kind of gone over this already, but if extrinsic motivation is what's working, is that really a bad thing by necessity?
Are you talking about later on in life?
Generally? Yeah, I guess so. And in terms of getting into college, and is that?
It's not necessarily a bad
mm-hmm.
thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ideal situation, it would be the case,
mm-hmm.
you know, that everyone's intrinsically motivated.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think extrinsic motivations are necessarily bad, you know,
mm-hmm.
to want, like, a nice
mm-hmm.
car, you know. You know,
mm-hmm.
to want nice things. You know, I don't think this is necessarily bad. But, you know, I think it becomes a problem, and this was said in a Bernadette Doran article called The Look Is You, and I'm going to paraphrase it. It's and they're talking about an issue with capitalism. What they say is that, because it was written by two authors, and I don't remember both of their names, but it says, you know, when people start forming their identity through acquiring, that being, you know, materials, extrinsic things, rather than becoming, that being education, intrinsic motivation, that's where the problem is, because all of a sudden you are defined by what you own. You turn yourself in, you're alienated from your own inner being by these external things. And so that's where I really see the negative effect from it. When you stop becoming something, when you stop trying to better your own self, that's when there's an issue.
Yeah, and you, again, in education, and for any educator, using those moments, even when implementing extrinsic motivation, using those moments to emphasize the act of writing or of reading or of math or of whatever it might be, I think that is certainly helpful in that process. Well, thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you, listeners.
Mm-hmm.
It's been fun for us.
Yeah, and keep updated on ethicstalk.cmich.edu for future shows. Thanks.
Bye. Good night.